Welcome back to the Griffith Small Podcast. My name is Emily Sockle, and with me today is my co-host, Anna Swan.
Hi, everyone. Today, we will be exploring the concept of defamation and how defamation laws operate in practice and intersect with the media.
We are honoured this week to be joined by John McMillan, who has held statutory positions of Commonwealth Ombudsman, Integrity Commissioner for the Australian Commission for Law Enforcement Integrity, Australian Information Commissioner, and New South Wales Ombudsman.
Now, in today's podcast, we will primarily focus on the successful defamation action which John had against the Canberra Times. However, we will also delve deeper into the operation of defamation laws considered by the Queensland Defamation Act of 2005. Obviously, John is from the ACT, so some legislation will differ, but we will primarily focus on the elements that were proven in his case and its operations in practice.
Would you mind explaining us to a bit about your history and the work you've done?
Emily and Anna, I've been practicing law for nearly 50 years, gulp, and there have been sort of three phases. One, I was an academic for many years, primarily at the Australian National University, teaching administrative and constitutional law. Then in a second phase, I held statutory positions in government, ombudsman in the Commonwealth of New South Wales, information commissioner responsible for FOI and privacy, and integrity commissioner responsible for anti-corruption, and also on the Australian Copyright Tribunal.
So as the focus of the podcast today is your successful defamation action, we might focus in on the particulars of that, if that's okay?
Yes, fine.
Okay, firstly, to ensure the viewers understand the concept of today's discussion, would you mind giving everyone a brief summary of what it means to defame someone?
Defamation simply means publishing a false statement that damages the reputation or public standing of a person. So you know, there are a number of elements. One, there has to be a false statement. It has to be the person to whom the statement relates must be identifiable. Sometimes that's direct, sometimes it's implicit. It has to be published to an audience. It may be an audience of one, but usually it's a broader audience. And then the other element is whether there is any defence available to the person who published the defamatory statement.
And so with those elements, what are some of the means in which defaming material may be published or shared?
The main way is through media articles. Classically, it was newspaper articles. More commonly today, it's probably radio and television broadcasts. Social media commentary and email commentary has become common, but it could also just be a conversation. The conversation we're having now would be a form of publication.
Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting that you mentioned news articles, because I believe in your case you were defamed by the Canberra Times. Is that correct?
Yes, it was an article written by one of their lead feature journalists, a journalist named Jack Waterford, and he writes a feature article in the Saturday paper. In the commentary and opinion section, and this was the article that on which I took action, because it identified me, I alleged, in a defamatory way.
I know you said that it was the article that he had published. When it was discovered, the article, what was said?
Well, I was a subscriber to the Canberra Times at the time. I no longer am, so I was like, picked up the Saturday paper, I saw this article that was essentially about me. The background is that I know Jack Waterford quite well. We were at university at the same time. We were friends for a while. Jack Waterford's been very critical of the work of Ombudsman and the operation of the Freedom of Information Act. And so understandably, I came as a subject of criticism. And so he'd written a few articles over the years in which there was commentary at me. This particular article was about the great contribution this fellow had made in areas like ombudsman work and freedom of information. And then midway through the article, it switched over and said, but you can't say the same about another person who worked with us on those projects, namely John McMillan. And then the rest of the article was a fairly blatant attack on my work and integrity. And, you know, for example, insinuations that I was only ever appointed to these positions by government because they knew that I would be tame and would never be critical, and I honoured that expectation because I never said anything that was critical of government, and you know, and so I was basically a good example of what can go wrong. So that was the article. Yep.
Yeah. So I will just check with you, John. I know in Queensland we turned to the Defamation Act 2005. However, in the Australian Capital Territory, I believe defamation forms, I think it was Chapter 9 of the Civil Law Wrongs Act. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. One of the big issues in defamation proceedings is in which jurisdiction you bring your proceedings. Now, essentially, the laws are the same in terms of what is defamation and what are the defences. The plaintiff can effectively choose their jurisdiction because most articles will have been published in more than one. And this was a good example. The Canberra Times article was syndicated in the Sydney Morning Herald, in a WA newspaper, in a Victorian newspaper. At the time I was living in Sydney, the lawyers I consulted were living in Sydney. But we decided to commence the proceedings in the ACT, principally for a strategic reason. The ACT doesn't have juries in defamation trials, whereas New South Wales and some other states often do. And the advice of defamation lawyers is that, look, public servants are not necessarily popular with the public. And so a jury, your prospects of success are probably lesser if your action is heard before a jury, because they may simply take the view that anybody on the public payroll is fair game for criticism, however it's phrased.
So would you say it is important that we have these laws to prevent people from being able to defame others?
Yes, I'm always a great believer in all of the basic tort law principles, you know, trespass, assault, defamation, negligence, and so on, because they do provide protection for people, albeit through the possibility of expensive legal proceedings, but they do provide it. But as I've indicated, the defamation laws do allow defences, and they allow defences of truth and fair comment on matters that are stated. So they don't, in my view, impede public interest journalism. They really force a journalist to be clear about what they are saying. Now, you will see that. It's very common in newspapers nowadays where they will write highly contentious articles criticising or identifying people, and they will often have a sentence or two that says, please, we are not alleging that. So, there are certain ways they can, if a journalist is careful and smart, the defamation laws don't necessarily prevent them from publishing quite contentious and forceful articles.
You know, if the action were to be unsuccessful, how do you think that would have also impacted your career as well?
Yeah, I had always vowed throughout my career never to bring defamation proceedings. You know, I was subject to constant defamation as a teacher. You know, student surveys, they make outrageous comments about you. And you think, well, you know, that's you accept that. As a public officer, as an ombudsman, putting out reports, as an information commissioner, making decisions, I was frequently subject to commentary and analysis, and I just accept that's part of the business. So I had always vowed never to bring defamation proceedings. And I'm also aware that litigation consumes people. you start thinking it'll all be over very quickly and it'll vindicate your rights, but it absolutely consumed people. So I was very cautious and wary. What flipped me over on this occasion were two things. One, I was nearing the end of my normal working career and would undertake consultancy work, and I knew that articles like this are now easily accessible on the internet. And if I were putting in full work and somebody wanted to do a reference check on me, they would Google, and this may be the article that comes up that says he's only ever appointed because he doesn't do his job properly. And secondly, because this was about the third occasion on which the journalists had written critical comments about me, and I had written, I'd taken the course of writing to the Canberra Times and saying, no, that's wrong, and the articles were getting stronger, I feared there was a personal vendetta. And at the end of the day, I'm a great believer in media freedom and so on, but the media is enormously powerful. They carry enormous power and they can do irreparable damage to people. Now, I'm aware, working in government, that government can do irreparable damage, but they're subject to courts, they're subject to ombudsmen, they're subject to tribunals, they're subject to integrity commissions. Journalists, apart from the Press Council and defamation law, they're not subject to any of that. So at the end of the day, that's why I decided, look, I will go and consult a defamation lawyer. Yeah. The object was not to get to a trial. The object was to get the Canberra Times to step back, apologise, pull down the article, and ensure there was no personal vendetta against me. So.
Yeah, so prior to the journalist publishing the material, do you think they thought of any defences which may have been available to him? Or
did they try and argue any defences?
The astute thing for a journalist to do, if they're going to comment, if they're going to criticise somebody, is to contact that person and say, I'm proposing to say this about you. And then all they need to do, by and large, is put a sentence in the article which says the person disputes these comments or has said such and such. Now, that didn't happen on this occasion. I was opening the paper over breakfast when you see these things. Why didn't the journalist take the person knew me, they had my phone number, why didn't they ring me? So really, there were no defences. The statement was clearly defamatory, for example, saying I was only ever appointed because I wouldn't do the job properly, and that I'd never made critical comments. So I just had endless examples of where that was wrong. So I knew the facts. And if the facts are wrong, then the defences of truth and fair comment on facts stated are no longer available. And other defences, qualified privilege and absolute privilege, wouldn't apply. So that's why, I kind of thought about it, carefully, and had good discussions with, the barrister and solicitor, and decided that, look, this is a, and they were of the same view. This is a clear cut example of defamation. And indeed, it was settled in my favour. I commenced proceedings. It was sent to mediation. It was clear from the opening minutes of the mediation that it was going to be, it was likely to be settled, and it was simply the terms of settlement. There was no attempt really to defend what was said. And right from the outset, from the first correspondence with the Canberra Times, we said, look, we're not interested in proceedings. All we want is either take down the article or admit that it's wrong. So at the end of the day, that's what I got, an apology and coverage of my legal costs. So,
yeah. Unfortunately, that is all we have time for today. Thank you so much, John, for joining us and giving us firsthand insight as to how defamation laws operate. I know both Anna and I have gained a much deeper realisation as to how defamation intersects with the media. So thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Thank you both.